They don't live there no more. They built another house across the field. This was just a shed, pretty much. My neighbor swears he's suing me for every penny he put into that place. That's why I came to you. You're the first lawyer I found who's open on a Sunday. Right. Well, I may have to do a little research before I can take your case, I say, but I'm thinking. He burned the guy's house down. There's no way to win this one. Esh takes a photograph out of the inner pocket of his coveralls and pushes it across the table. You can see the place in the background here, behind my wife. My neighbor says it's $25,000 I'll have to pay out. I glance at the photo. Calling this place a shed is generous. Me, I'd have said shack. Mr. Esh, I say, I think we can definitely get that down to 15.
This ends Disc 2. House Rules, Disc 3.
Jacob. Here are all the reasons I hate Mark, the boyfriend Jess has had since last September. 1. He makes her cry sometimes. 2. Once I saw bruises on her side, and I think he's the one who gave them to her. 3. He always wears a big orange Bengals sweatshirt. 4. He calls me Chief when I have explained multiple times that my name is Jacob. 5. He thinks I'm retarded, even though the diagnosis of mental retardation is reserved for people who score lower than 70 on an IQ test, and I myself have scored 162. In my opinion, the very fact that Mark doesn't know this diagnostic criterion suggests that he's a lot closer to actual retardation than I am. 6. Last month, I saw Mark in CVS with some other guys when Jess was not around. I said hello, but he pretended that he didn't know me. When I told Jess and she confronted him, he denied it, which means that he is both a hypocrite and a liar. I wasn't expecting him to be at today's lesson, and for that reason, I start to feel out of control right away, even though being with Jess usually calms me down. The best way I can describe it is like being in the path of a flash flood. You might be able to sense that a catastrophe is imminent. You might feel the faintest mist on your face. But even when you see that wall of water rushing toward you, you know you are powerless to budge an inch. Jacob, Jess says, as soon as I walk in. But I see Mark across the room sitting in a booth, and just like that, I can hardly even hear her voice. What's he doing here? You know he's my boyfriend, Jacob, and he wanted to come today, to help. Right, and I want to be drawn and quartered just for giggles. Jess links her arm through mine. It took me a while to get used to that, and to the perfume she wears, which isn't very strong, but to me smelled like an overdose of flowers. It's going to be fine, she says. Besides, we said we're going to work on being friendly to people we don't know, right? I know Mark, I replied, and I don't like him. But I do, and part of being social means being civil to someone you don't like. That's stupid. It's a huge world. Why not get up and walk away? Because that's rude, Jess explains. I think it's rude to stick a smile on your face and pretend you like talking to someone when in reality you'd rather be sticking bamboo slivers under your fingernails. Jess laughs. Jacob, one day when we wake up in the world of the painfully honest, you can be my tutor. A man comes down the stairs that lead up from the entryway of the pizza place. He has a dog on a leash, a miniature poodle. I step into his path and start patting the dog. Thor, down, he says. But the dog doesn't listen. Did you know poodles aren't French? In fact, the name poodle comes from the German word poodle, which is short for Pudelhund, or splashing dog. The breed used to be a water dog. I didn't know that, the man says. I do, because before I used to study forensics, I studied dogs. A poodle took best in show at Westminster in 2002, I add. Right. Well, this poodle's going to take a whiz if I don't get him outside, the man says, and he pushes past me. Jacob, Jess says, you don't just accost someone and start rattling off facts. He was interested in poodles. He has one. Right, but you could have started off by saying, hey, that's a really cute dog. I snort. That's not informative at all. No, but it's polite. At first, when Jess and I started working together, I used to call her a few days before our lesson, just to make sure it was still on, that she wasn't sick or expecting to have some kind of emergency. I'd call whenever I was obsessing about it, and sometimes that was 3 in the morning. If she didn't pick up her cell phone, I'd freak out. Once, I called the police to report her missing, and it turned out that she was just at some party. Eventually, we agreed that I would call her at 10 p.m. on Thursdays. Since I meet with her on Sundays and Tuesdays, that means I don't have to spend 4 days out of touch and worrying. This week, she moved out of her dorm and into a professor's house. She's babysitting for the house, which sounds like an immense waste of time, because it's not as if the house is going to touch the stove if it's hot, or eat something poisonous, or fall down its own stairs. She will be there for the semester, so next week we are going to meet there for our lesson. In my wallet, I have the address and the phone number and a special map she's drawn, but I'm a little nervous about it. It'll probably smell like someone else instead of Jess and flowers. Plus, I have no idea what it looks like yet, and I hate surprises. Jess is beautiful. Although she says this was not always the case, she lost a lot of weight 2 years ago after she had an operation. I've seen pictures of her before when she was obese. She says that's why she wants to work with kids whose disabilities make them targets, because she remembers being one too. In the picture, she looks like Jess, but hidden inside someone larger and puffier. Now, she's curvy, but only in the right places. She has blonde hair that is always straight, although she has to work hard to make that happen. I have watched her use this contraption called a flat iron that looks like a sandwich press, but actually sizzles her curly, wet hair and turns it smooth and silky. When she walks into a room, people look right at her, which I really like, because it means they're not looking at me. Lately, I've been thinking that maybe she should be my girlfriend. It makes sense. 1. She has seen me wear the same shirt 2 in a row and doesn't make a big deal about it. 2. She's getting a master's degree in education and is writing an enormous paper about Asperger's syndrome, so I'm hands-on research for her. 3. She is the only girl, other than my mother, who can put her hand on my arm to get my attention without making me want to jump out of my skin. 4. She ties her hair back into a ponytail without me even having to ask. 5. She is allergic to mangoes, and I don't like them. 6. I could call her whenever I want, not just Thursdays. 7. I would treat her so much better than Mark. And of course, the most important reason of all, 8. If I had a girlfriend, I'd appear to be more normal. Come on, Jess says, tapping me on the shoulder. You and I have work to do. Your mom says this place has gluten-free pizza. They make it on some kind of special crust. I know what love is. When you find the person you're supposed to love, bells ring and fireworks go off in your head, and you can't find words to speak, and you think about her all the time. When you find the person you're supposed to love, you will know by staring deeply into her eyes. Well, that's a deal breaker for me. It's hard for me to explain why it's so difficult to look into people's eyes. Imagine what it would be like if someone sliced your chest with a scalpel and rummaged around inside you, squeezing your heart and lungs and kidneys. That level of complete invasion is what it feels like when I make eye contact. The reason I choose not to look at people is that I don't think it's polite to rifle through someone's thoughts, and the eyes might as well be glass windows. They're that transparent. I know what love is, but only theoretically. I don't feel it the way other people do. Instead, I dissect it. Oh, my mother is putting her arms around me and telling me how proud she is of me. She is offering me her last French fry, even though I know she wants it. If P, then Q. If she acts this way, then she must love me. Jess spends time with me that she could otherwise spend with Mark. She doesn't get angry with me, except for the time when I took all the clothes out of her closet in her dorm room and tried to organize them like mine. She watches Crime Busters when we're together, although the sight of blood makes her faint. If P, then Q. Maybe I'll tell Jess my idea today, and she will say yes to being my girlfriend, and I will never have to see Mark again. In psychoanalytic theory, there's a phenomenon called transference. The therapist becomes a blank screen onto which the patient projects some incident or feeling that began in childhood. For example, a patient who spends sessions silent might be asked by the therapist if there is a reason she doesn't feel comfortable making free associations. Is it because she is afraid the therapist will find her comments stupid? And then, lo and behold, the patient breaks down. That's what my father used to call me, stupid. Suddenly, with the dam broken, the patient will begin to recall all sorts of repressed childhood memories. My mother never called me stupid. However, it would not be a far reach for someone to look at my feelings for Jess and assume that, in the context of our relationship as tutor and pupil, I am not in love. I'm just in transference. A medium gluten-free pizza, I say to the mountainous woman at the cash register, who is Greek. If she's Greek, why does she have an Italian restaurant? Jess nudges me. Please, I add. Eye contact, Jess murmurs. I force myself to look at the woman. She has hair growing on her upper lip. Please, I repeat, and I hand her the money. She gives me back my change. I'll bring it over when it's ready, the woman says, and she turns back to the wide mouth of the oven. She sticks an enormous paddle inside, like a tongue, and pulls out a calzone. So, how's school going? Jess asks. It's okay. Did you do your homework? She doesn't mean my academic homework, which I always do. She means my social skills homework. I grimace, thinking about our last lesson. Not quite. Jacob, you promised. I didn't promise. I said I would try to strike up a conversation with someone my own age, and I did. Well, that's great, Jess says. What happened? I had been in the library at the Bank of Computers, and there was a kid sitting next to me. Owen is in my advanced placement physics class. He is really quiet and very smart. And if you ask me, he has a little bit of Asperger's in him. It's like Gaydar. I can tell. For fun, I had been on a search engine researching fracture pattern interpretation in the skull, and how you can differentiate between blunt force trauma and ballistic trauma using concentric fractures, and that factoid seemed to be the perfect opening salvo for a conversation. But I remember Jess saying that not everyone is wowed by someone who's the human equivalent of a Snapple cap. So instead, I said this. Me. Are you going to take the AP test in May? Owen.
I don't know, I guess.
Me, snickering. Well, I sure hope they don't find semen. Owen.
What the hell?
Me. An AP test, acid phosphatase test. It's used with a forensic light source to test for presumptive semen. It's not as conclusive as DNA, but then again, when you get a rapist who's had a vasectomy, there won't be any sperm. And if an AP test and a 530 nanometer tri-spot is all you've got... Owen. Get the fuck away from me, freak. Jess has gone all red in the face. The good news, she says evenly, is that you tried to initiate a conversation. That's a really big step. The fact that you chose to discuss semen is unfortunate, but still. By now, we have reached the table in the back where Mark is waiting for us. He is chewing gum with his mouth wide open and wearing that stupid orange sweatshirt.
"Hey, Chief,"
he says. I shake my head and take a step backward. That sweatshirt. He wasn't wearing it when I first saw him. I bet he put it on purpose because he knows I don't like it. "Mark," Jess says after glancing at me, "the sweatshirt. Take it off." He grins at her.
"But it's more fun when you do it, baby," he says.
And he grabs Jess and tugs her into the booth, practically onto his lap. Let me just come out and say I don't get the sex thing. I don't understand why someone like Mark, who seems completely hell-bent on exchanging bodily fluids with Jess, isn't equally excited to talk about the fact that snot, bleach, and horseradish can all give you false positives for blood during presumptive tests. And I don't understand why neurotypical guys are obsessed with girl breasts. I think it would be an enormous pain to have those sticking out in front of you all the time. Fortunately, Mark does take off the orange sweatshirt, and Jess folds it up and puts it on the seat where I can't see it. It's bad enough just knowing it's there, frankly.
"You get me mushroom?" Mark asks.
You know Jacob isn't a fan of mushroom. There's a lot I'd do for Jess, but not mushrooms. Even if they're touching the crust on the far side of the pizza, I might have to vomit. She pulls her cell phone out of her pocket and sets it on the table. It's pink and has my name and number programmed into it. It might be the only cell phone that has my name in it. Even my mother's cell phone lists our number as home. I stare down at the table, thinking about Mark's sweatshirt.
"Mark,"
Jess says, sliding his hand out of the back of her shirt. "Come on, we're in public." Then she addresses me. "Jacob, while we're waiting for the food, let's practice." Practice waiting? I don't really need to. I'm fairly proficient at it. When there's a lull in the conversation, you can toss out a topic that gets people talking again.
"Yeah," Mark says. Chicken nuggets are neither chicken nor nuggets. Discuss."
"You're not helping," Jess mutters. "Are you looking forward to anything this week in school, Jacob?"
"Sure.
Rampant dismissal and abject humiliation. In other words, the usual. In physics, I have to explain gravity to the rest of the class," I say. "The grade's half on content and half on creativity, and I think I've found the perfect solution." It took me a while to think of this, and then when I did, I couldn't believe I hadn't thought of it before.
"I'm going to drop my pants," I tell her.
Mark bursts out laughing, and for a second, I think maybe I've misjudged him. "Jacob," Jess says, "you will not drop your pants."
"It completely explains Newton's law."
"I don't care if it explains the meaning of life. Think about how inappropriate that would be. Not only would you embarrass your teacher and make him angry, but you'd be teased by other students for doing it."
"I don't know, Jess. You know what they say about guys with long IEPs," Mark says.
"Well, you don't have an IEP," Jess answers, smiling. "So there goes that theory."
"You know it, baby."
I have no idea what they're talking about. When Jess is my girlfriend, we will eat pizza without mushrooms every Sunday. I'll show her how to enhance the contrast of fingerprints on packing tape, and I will let her read my Crime Busters journals. She'll confide that she has quirks too, like the fact that she has a tail that she keeps hidden under her jeans.
Okay, maybe not a tail. No one really wants a girlfriend with a tail.
"I have something to talk about," I say. My heart starts pounding, and my palms are sweaty. I analyze this the way Dr. Henry Lee would analyze any other piece of forensic evidence and store it away for the future. Asking girls out can cause changes to the cardiovascular system. "I would like to know, Jess, if you would like to accompany me to a movie this Friday night."
"Oh, Jacob, well done. We haven't practiced that in a whole month."
"On Thursday, I'll know what's playing. I can look it up on moviephone.com. I fold my napkin into eights. "I could go out on Saturday instead if it's better for you. There's a Crime Busters marathon, but I'm willing to make a sacrifice. Surely that will show her how serious I am about this relationship. Holy shit, Mark says, grinning. I can feel his eyes on me. That's the other thing about eyes. They can be hot as lasers. And how would you ever know when they're about to be turned on full force? Better not to risk it and to avoid eye contact. He isn't showing you some communication skill, Jess. The retard is actually asking you out. Mark, for God's sake, don't call him... I'm not a retard, I interrupt. You're wrong. Jacob knows we're just friends, Jess says. Mark snorts. You fucking get paid to be his friend. I stand up abruptly. Is that true? I guess I've never thought about it. My mother arranged for me to meet with Jess. I assume Jess wanted to do it because A, she is writing that paper, and B, likes my company. But now I can picture my mother ripping another check out of her checkbook and complaining like always that we don't have enough to cover our expenses. I can picture Jess opening the envelope in her dorm room and tucking that check into the back pocket of her jeans. I can picture her taking Mark out for pizza, using cash that came from my mother's bank account. Gluten-rich mushroom pizza. It's not true, Jess says. I am your friend, Jacob. But you wouldn't be hanging out with Forrest Gump if you didn't get that sweet check every month, Mark says. She turns on him. Mark, go away. Did you say what I think you said? Are you taking his side? I start rocking back and forth. Nobody puts baby in a corner, I quote under my breath. This isn't about sides, Jess says. Right, Mark snaps. It's about priorities. I want to take you skiing for the afternoon, and you blow me off. I didn't blow you off. I invited you along to a standing appointment I had, one that I couldn't just change at the last minute. I already explained to you how important plans are to someone with Asperger's. Jess grabs Mark's arm, but he shakes her off. This is bullshit. I might as well be fucking Mother Teresa. He storms out of the pizza place. I don't understand what Jess likes about him. He is in the graduate school of business, and he plays a lot of hockey. But whenever he's around, the conversation always has to be about him. And I don't know why that's okay if it's Mark talking, but not if it's me. Jess rests her head on her folded arms. Her hair is spread out over her shoulders like a cape. From the way her shoulders are moving, she is probably crying. Annie Sullivan, I say. What? Jess looks up. Her eyes are red. Mother Teresa saved the poor and the sick. I'm not poor or sick. Annie Sullivan would have been a better example to use because she's a famous teacher. Oh, God. Jess buries her face in her hands. I can't handle this. There is a lull in the conversation, so I fill it. Are you free on Friday now? You can't be serious. I consider this. Actually, I'm serious all the time. Usually I get accused of not having a sense of humor, although I am capable of that, too. Does it matter to you that Mark is the first guy who's ever told me I'm pretty? Or that I actually love him? Her voice is climbing, each word another step on a ladder. Do you even care if I'm happy? No, no, and yes. I'm getting flustered. Why is she asking me all these things? Mark's gone now, and we can get back to business. So I made a list of the things people sometimes say that really mean they're tired of listening to you, but I don't know if they're right. Can you check it? Jesus Christ, Jacob! Jess cries. Just get lost! Her words are huge and fill the entire pizza place. Everyone is watching. I have to go talk to him. She stands up. But what about my lesson? Why don't you think about what you've learned, Jess says, and get back to me. Then she stomps out of the restaurant, leaving me alone at the table. The pizza lady brings out the pie, which I will have to eat by myself now. "Hope you're hungry," she says. I'm not. But I lift up a slice anyway and take a bite and swallow. It tastes like cardboard. Something pink winks at me from the other side of the napkin dispenser. Jess has left behind her cell phone. I would call her to tell her I have it, but obviously that won't work. I tuck it into my pocket and make a mental note. I'll just bring it to her when we meet on Tuesday, when I've figured out what it is that I'm supposed to have learned. For over a decade now, we have received a Christmas card from a family I do not know. They address it to the Jenningses, who lived in the house before we did. There's usually a snowy scene on the front. And then inside, there is printed gold lettering, "Happy Holidays, fondly, the Steinbergs." The Steinbergs also include a photocopied note that chronicles everything they have been doing over the years. I've read about their daughter Sarah, who went from taking gymnastics lessons, to being accepted at Vassar, to joining a consulting firm, to moving to an ashram in India and adopting a baby. I've come to know Marty Steinberg's big career breaks at Lehman Brothers and his shock at being out of a job in 2008 when the company folded, and how he went on to teach business at a community college in upstate New York. I've seen Vicky, his wife, go from being a stay-at-home mom to an entrepreneur selling cookies with the faces of pedigreed dogs on them. One year, there were samples. This year, Marty took a leave of absence, and he and Vicky went on a cruise to Antarctica, apparently a lifelong dream that was now possible since Yukonuba had bought out Vicky's company. Sarah and her partner Inez got married in California, and there was a picture of Rita, now 3, as the flower girl. Each Christmas season, I try to get to the Steinbergs' letter before my mother does. She tosses them into the trash, saying things like, "Don't these people ever get the message when the Jenningses don't send a card back?" I fish the card out and put it in a shoebox I have reserved specially for the Steinbergs in my closet. I don't know why reading their holiday cards makes me feel good, the same way a warm load of laundry does when I'm lying underneath it, or when I take the thesaurus and read through an entire letter's words in one sitting. But today, after I come home from my meeting with Jess, I suffer through the obligatory conversation with my mother, "Mom, how did it go?" "Me, fine." And then go straight up to my room. Like an addict who needs a fix, I go right to the Steinberg letters and I reread them, from the oldest to the most recent. It gets a little easier to breathe again. And when I close my eyes, I don't see Jess's face on the backs of my lids, grainy like a drawing on an etch-a-sketch. It's like some kind of cryptogram, and A really means Q, and Z really means S, and so on. So the twist of her mouth and the funny note that jumped in her voice are what she really wanted to say, instead of the words she used. I lie down and imagine showing up on the doorstep of Sarah and Inez. "It is so good to see you," I'd say. "You look exactly like I thought you would." I pretend that Vicky and Marty are sitting on the deck of their ship. Marty is sipping a martini while Vicky writes out a postcard with a picture of Valletta, Malta on the front. She scrawls, "Wish you were here." And this time, she addresses it directly to me.
Emma. Nobody dreams of being an agony aunt when they grow up. Secretly, we all read advice columns. Who hasn't scanned Dear Abby? But sifting through the problems of other people for a living? No thanks. I thought that by now I'd be a real writer. I'd have books on the New York Times list and I'd be feted by the literati for my ability to combine important issues with books that the masses could relate to. Like many other writer wannabes, I'd gone the back route through editing, textbooks in my case. I liked editing. There was always a right and a wrong answer. And I had assumed that I'd go back to work when Jacob was in school full time. But that was before I learned that being an advocate for your autistic child's education is a 40-hour-a-week profession in and of itself. All sorts of adaptations had to be argued for and vigilantly monitored. A cool-off pass that would allow Jacob to leave a classroom that got too overwhelming for him. A sensory break room. A paraprofessional who could help him, as an elementary school student, put his thoughts into writing. An individualized education plan. A school counselor who didn't roll her eyes every time Jacob had a meltdown. I did some freelance editing at night. Texts referred to me by a sympathetic former boss. But it wasn't enough to support us. So when the Burlington Free Press ran a contest for a new column, I wrote one. I didn't know about photography or chess or gardening, so I picked something I knew. Parenting. My first column asked why, no matter how hard we tried as moms, we always felt like we weren't doing enough. The paper got over 300 letters in response to that test column, and suddenly, I was the parenting advice expert. This blossomed into advice for those without kids, for those who wanted kids, for those who didn't. Subscriptions increased when my column bumped from once a week to twice a week. And here's the really remarkable thing. All these people who trust me to sort out their own sorry lives assume that I have a clue when it comes to sorting out my own. Today's question comes from Warren, Vermont. Help! My wonderful, polite, sweet 12-year-old boy has turned into a monster. I've tried punishing him, but nothing works. Why is he acting up? I lean over my keyboard and start to type. Whenever a child misbehaves, there's some deeper issue driving the action. Sure, you can take away privileges, but that's putting a Band-Aid over a gaping wound. You need to be a detective and figure out what's really upsetting him. I reread what I've written, then delete the whole paragraph. Who am I kidding? Well, the greater Burlington area, apparently. My son sneaks out at night to crime scenes, and do I heed my own advice? No. I'm saved from my hypocrisy by the sound of the telephone ringing. It's Monday night, just after 8, so I assume it's for Theo. He picks up on an extension upstairs, and a moment later appears in the kitchen. It's for you, Theo says. He waits till I pick up and disappears into the sanctuary of his bedroom again. This is Emma, I say into the receiver.
Miss Hunt, this is Jack Thornton, Jacob's math teacher.
Inwardly, I cringe. There are some teachers who see the greater good in Jacob, in spite of all his quirks, and there are others who just don't get him and don't bother to try. Jack Thornton expected Jacob to be a math savant, when that's not always part of Asperger's, in spite of what Hollywood seems to think. Instead, he's been frustrated by a student whose handwriting is messy, who transposes numbers when doing calculations, and who is far too literal to understand some of the theoretical concepts of math, like imaginary numbers and matrices. If Jack Thornton is calling me, it can't be good news.
Did Jacob tell you what happened today?
Had Jacob mentioned anything? No, I would remember. But then again, he probably wouldn't confess unless he was directly asked. More likely, I would have read the clues through his behavior, which would have seemed a little off. Usually when Jacob's even more withdrawn, or stimming, or conversely, too talkative or manic, I know something's wrong. In this way, I am a better forensic scientist than Jacob would ever guess.
I asked Jacob to come up to the board to write out his homework answer,
Thornton explains.
And when I told him that his work was sloppy, he shoved me.
Shoved you?
Yes, the teacher says. You can imagine the reaction of the rest of the class.
Well, that explains why I didn't see a deterioration in Jacob's behavior. When the class started laughing, he would have assumed he'd done something good. "I'm sorry," I say. "I'll talk to him." No sooner have I hung up the phone than Jacob appears in the kitchen and takes the carton of milk out of the fridge. "Did something happen in math class today?" I ask. Jacob's eyes widen.
"You can't handle the truth,"
he says, in a dead-on imitation of Jack Nicholson, as sure a sign as any that he's squirming. "I already talked to Mr. Thornton, Jacob. You can't go around shoving teachers."
"He started it."
"He didn't shove you."
"No, but he said, 'Jacob, my 3-year-old could write more neatly than that.' And you're always saying that when someone makes fun of me, I should stick up for myself."
The truth is, I have said that to Jacob. And there's a piece of me rejoicing in the fact that he initiated an interaction with another human instead of the other way around, even if the interaction wasn't socially appropriate. The world, for Jacob, is truly black and white. Once, when he was younger, his gym teacher called because Jacob had a meltdown during kickball when a kid threw the big red ball at him to tag him out.
"You don't throw things at people,"
Jacob tearfully explained.
"It's a rule."
Why should a rule that works in one situation not work in another? If a bully taunts him and I tell him it's all right to reciprocate, because sometimes that's the only way to get these kids to leave him alone, why shouldn't he do the same with a teacher who humiliates him in public? Teachers deserve respect, I explain.
"Why do they get it for free when everyone else has to earn it?"
I blink at him, speechless. Because the world isn't fair, I think. But Jacob already knows that better than most of us.
"Are you mad at me?"
Unfazed, he reaches for a glass and pours himself some soy milk. I think that's the attribute I miss seeing the most in my son. Empathy. He worries about hurting my feelings or making me upset, but that's not the same as viscerally feeling someone else's pain. Over the years, he's learned empathy the way I might learn Greek, translating an image or situation in the clearinghouse of his mind and trying to attach the appropriate sentiment to it, but never really fluent in the language. Last spring, we were filling one of his prescriptions at the pharmacy, and I noticed a rack of Mother's Day cards. "Just once, I'd like you to buy one of those for me," I said.
"Why?"
Jacob asked. "So I know you love me." He shrugged.
"You already know that."
"But it would be nice," I said, "to wake up on Mother's Day and, like every other mother in this country, to get a card from her son." Jacob thought about this.
"What day is Mother's Day?"
he asked. I told him, and then I forgot about the conversation until May 10th. When I went downstairs and started my Sunday morning coffee-making routine, I found an envelope propped up against the glass carafe. In it was a Mother's Day card. It didn't say, "Dear Mom." It wasn't signed. In fact, it wasn't written on at all, because Jacob had only done what I'd told him to do, and nothing more. That day, I sat down at the kitchen table and laughed. I laughed until I started to cry. Now, I look up at my son, who isn't looking at me. "No, Jacob," I say, "I'm not mad at you." Once, when Jacob was 10, we were walking the aisles of a Toys R Us in Williston when a little boy jumped out from an end cap wearing a Darth Vader mask and brandishing a lightsaber.
"Bang! You're dead!"
the boy cried, and Jacob believed him. He started shrieking and rocking, and then he swept his arm through the display on the shelves. He was doing it to make sure he wasn't a ghost, to make sure he still could leave an impact in this world. He spun and flailed, trampling boxes as he ran away from me. By the time I tackled him in the doll section, he was completely out of control. I tried singing Marley to him. I shouted at him to make him respond to my voice. But Jacob was in his own little world. And finally, the only way I could make him calm was to become a human blanket, to pin him down on the industrial tile with his arms and legs flung wide. By then, the police had been called on suspicion of child abuse. It took 15 minutes to explain to the officers that my son was autistic and that I wasn't trying to hurt him, I was trying to help him. I've often thought, since then, about what would happen if Jacob was stopped by the police while he was on his own. Like on Sundays, when he bikes into town to meet Jess. Like the parents of many autistic kids, I've done what the message boards suggest. In Jacob's wallet is a card that says he's autistic, and that explains to the officer that all the behaviors Jacob is exhibiting, flat affect, an inability to look him in the eye, even a flight response, are the hallmarks of Asperger's syndrome. And yet, I've wondered what would happen if the police came in contact with a 6-foot, 185-pound, out-of-control boy who reached into his back pocket. Would they wait for him to show his ID card, or would they shoot first? This, in part, is why Jacob isn't allowed to drive. He's had the state driver's manual memorized since he was 15, and I know he'd follow traffic rules as if his life depended on it. But what if he got pulled over by a state trooper? "Do you know what you were doing?" the trooper would say, and Jacob would reply, "Driving." Immediately, he'd be tagged as a wise guy, when in fact he was only answering the question literally. If the trooper asked him if he ran a red light, Jacob would say yes, even if it had happened 6 months earlier when the trooper was nowhere nearby. I know better than to ask him whether my butt looks fat in a particular pair of jeans because he'll tell me the truth. A police officer wouldn't have that history to help color Jacob's answer. Well, at any rate, they're not likely to stop him while he's riding into town on his bicycle, unless they take pity on him because it's so cold. I learned a long time ago to stop asking Jacob if he wants a ride. The temperature matters less to him than his independence in this one small thing. Hauling the laundry basket into Jacob's room, I place his folded clothes on the bed. When he comes home from school, he'll put them away on his own, with all the collars all lined up precisely and the boxer shorts arranged by pattern, stripes, solids, polka dots. On his desk is an overturned fish tank with a small coffee cup warmer, a tinfoil dish, and one of my lipstick containers beneath it. Sighing, I lift the fingerprint fuming chamber and reclaim my makeup, careful not to disturb the rest of the precisely ordered items. Jacob's room has the nuclear precision of an Architectural Digest feature. Everything has its place. The bed is made neatly. The pencils on the desk sit at perfect right angles to the wood grain. Jacob's room is the place entropy goes to die. On the other hand, Theo is messy enough to make up for both of them. I can barely kick my way through the field of dirty clothes tangled on his carpet, and when I set the basket down on Theo's bed, something squeaks. I don't put away Theo's laundry either, but that's because I can't bear to see the drawers haphazardly stuffed with clothes that I distinctly remember folding on the laundry counter. I glance around and spy a glass with something green festering inside it, beside a half-eaten container of yogurt. I place these into the empty basket to go back downstairs, and then, in a fit of kindness, try to pull the bedding into some semblance of order. It's when I'm shaking the pillowcase into position around Theo's pillow that the plastic case falls down and hits my ankle. It's a game, something called Naruto, with a manga cartoon character brandishing a sword. It's played on the Wii, a gaming system we've never owned. I could ask Theo why he has this, but something tells me I don't want to hear the answer. Not after this weekend, when I learned that Jacob's been running away at night. Not after last night, when his math teacher called to tell me he's acting out in class. Sometimes, I think the human heart is just a simple shelf. There's only so much you can pile onto it before something falls off an edge and you're left to pick up the pieces. I stare at the video game for a moment, and then I slip it back into the pillowcase again before leaving Theo's room.
Theo. I taught my brother how to stick up for himself. It happened when we were younger. I was 11 and he was 14. I was on a jungle gym on the playground and he was sitting on the grass, reading a biography that the librarian had purchased just for him about Edmond Lacaze, the father of fingerprint analysis. Mom was inside having one of a bazillion IEP meetings to make sure that Jacob's school could be as safe a place for him as his home. Apparently, that didn't include the playground. Two boys on incredibly sweet skateboards were doing tricks on the stairs when they spotted Jacob. They walked over, and one of them grabbed his book. "That's mine," Jacob said. "Then come and get it," the kid said. He tossed the book to his buddy, who tossed it back, playing monkey in the middle with Jacob, who kept grabbing at it. But Jacob isn't exactly a natural athlete, and he never caught it. "It's a library book, you cretins," Jacob said, as if that might make a difference. "It's going to get ruined." "That would suck." The boy tossed the book into a huge mud puddle. "Better rescue it," his friend added, and Jacob dove for the book. I called out to him, but it was too late. One of the boys knocked Jacob's feet out from underneath him so that he landed face first in the puddle. He sat up, soaking wet, spitting dirt. "Happy reading, tard," the first boy said, and they both laughed and skated away. Jacob didn't move. He sat in the puddle, holding the book to his chest. "Get up," I said, and I held out my hand to help him. With a grunt, Jacob stood. He tried to turn the pages in the book, but they were glued together with mud. "It'll dry," I said. "You want me to get Mom?" He shook his head. "She'll be mad at me." "No, she won't," I said, even though he was probably right. His clothes were totally destroyed. "Jacob, you've got to learn to fight back. Do whatever they do, only 10 times worse." "Push them into a puddle?" "Well, no. You can just, I don't know, call them names." "Their names are Sean and Amal," Jacob said. "Not those names. Try, you dickhead, or cut it out, prick." "That's swearing." "Yeah, but it'll get them to think twice before they cream you again." Jacob started rocking. During the Vietnam War, the BBC was worried about how to pronounce the name of a bombed village, Phuoc Mi, without offending their listeners. They decided to use the name of a nearby village instead. Unfortunately, it was called Ban Mi Thuot. "Well, maybe the next time a bully is holding your face down in a mud puddle, you can shout out the names of Vietnamese villages." "I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too," Jacob quoted. "You might want to go a little more hardcore," I suggested. He thought for a moment. "Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker." "Nice. So next time a kid like that grabs your book, what do you say?" "Puss bucket asshole, give it back." I burst out laughing. "Jacob," I said, "you just might be gifted at this." I honestly don't have any intention of going into another house. But then on Tuesday, I have an absolutely crappy day at school. First, I get a 79 on a math test, and I never get C's. Second, I'm the only kid whose yeast doesn't manage to grow in the lab we're doing in bio. And third, I think I'm getting a cold. I cut last period because I just want to huddle in bed with a cup of tea. In fact, it's the craving for tea which makes me think about that professor's house I was in last week. And as luck would have it, I'm only 3 blocks away when the thought enters my mind. There's still no one in the house, and I don't even have to jimmy the back door. It's been left unlocked. The cane is still leaning against the entryway wall, and that same hoodie is hanging, but now there's a wool coat, too, and a pair of work boots. Someone's finished the bottle of red wine. There's a Bose stereo on the counter that wasn't there last week, and a hot pink iPod Nano is charging in its dock. I push the power button and see that Neo is queued up. Either these are the hippest professors ever, or their grandkids need to stop leaving their shit lying around. The tea kettle is sitting on the stove, so I fill it up and turn on the burner while I rummage around the cabinets for a tea bag. They're hiding on a shelf behind a roll of tinfoil. I choose Mango Madness. And while my water is heating, I scroll through the iPod. I'm impressed. My mom can barely figure out how to use iTunes, and yet here is some elderly professor couple whizzing through technology. I suppose they might not be that old. I've imagined them that way. But maybe the cane is for arthroscopic surgery, because the professor plays hockey on the weekends and blew out his knee as a goalie. Maybe they're my mom's age and the hoodie belongs to their daughter, who's my age. Maybe she goes to my school, or even sits next to me in biology. I slip the iPod into my pocket and pour the water from the whistling kettle, and that's when I realize that I can hear a shower running above me. Forgetting my tea, I creep into the living room, past the monster entertainment system, and up the stairs. The water sound is coming from the master bathroom suite. The bed's unmade. It's a quilt with roses embroidered all over it, and there's a pile of clothes on a chair. I pick up a lacy bra and run my hand over the straps. That's when I realize that the bathroom door's ajar, and that I can sort of see the shower reflected in the mirror. My day has gotten considerably better in the past 30 seconds. There's steam, so I can only make out the curves when she turns and the fact that her hair reaches her shoulders. She's humming, and she's wicked off key. "Turn," I silently beg. "Full frontal." "Oh, crap," the woman says, and suddenly she opens the door of the shower. I see her arm emerge as she blindly feels around for her towel, which is hanging on a rack beside the shower door, and wipes her eyes. I hold my breath, staring at her shoulder, her boob. Still blinking, she lets go of the towel and turns. In that second, our eyes meet.
Jacob. People say things all the time they don't mean, and neurotypical folks manage to figure out the message all the same. Take, for example, Mimi Scheck in school. She said she'd die if Paul McGrath didn't ask her to the winter formal, but in reality, she would not have died. She would have just been really sad. Or the way Theo sometimes smacks another kid's shoulder and says, "Get out!" when that really means he wants his friend to keep talking. Or that time my mom muttered, "Oh, that's just great," when we got a flat tire on the highway, although it clearly was not great. It was a colossal hassle. So maybe when Jess told me to get lost on Sunday, she really meant something else. I think I might be dying of spinal meningitis. Headaches, dementia, stiffness of the neck, high fever. I have 2 out of the 4. I don't know if I should ask my mother to take me for a lumbar puncture or just ride it out until I die. I have already prepared a note explaining how I'd like to be dressed at my funeral, just in case. It is equally possible, I suppose, that the reason I have a severe headache and stiff neck is I have gotten no sleep since Sunday, when I last saw Jess. She didn't send me pictures of her new house in advance like she promised. I sent her 48 emails yesterday to remind her, and she didn't respond to any of them. I can't call to remind her to send the pictures because I still have her cell phone. Last night at 4 a.m, I asked myself what Dr. Henry Lee would do if confronted with the evidence that 1. No photos ever arrived by email. 2. None of my 48 messages were acknowledged. Hypothesis 1 would be that Jess's email account is not functional, which seems highly unlikely because it is connected with the entirety of UVM. Hypothesis 2 would be that she is actively choosing to not communicate with me, which would indicate anger or frustration, see above, just get lost. But that doesn't make sense, since she specifically told me at our last meeting that I should tell her what I'd learned, which implies another meeting. Incidentally, I have made a list of what I learned at our last meeting. 1. Gluten-free pizza tastes disgusting. 2. Jess is not available to go to a movie this Friday night. 3. Her cell phone sounds like a bird chirping when you power it down. 4. Mark is a dim-witted moron. Although, in fairness, this is A, redundant, and B, something I already knew. The only reason I went to school today, feeling as awful as I do, is that if I stayed home, I know my mother would insist I miss my lesson with Jess, and I can't do that. I have to give her back her phone, after all, and if I see her face to face, I can ask her why she didn't answer my emails. Usually it's Theo's job to walk me to the UVM campus, which is only a half mile from school. He drops me off at Jess's dorm room, which she has always left unlocked for me, so that I can wait for her until she gets out of her anthropology class. Sometimes I do my homework while I'm waiting, and sometimes I look through the papers on her desk. Once, I sprayed her perfume on my clothes and went around smelling like her for the rest of the day. Then, Jess shows up, and we go to the library to work, or sometimes to the student union or a cafe on Church Street. I could probably get to Jess's dorm while comatose, but today, when I really do need Theo's help to find my way to a new location, he leaves school because he's sick. He searches me out after sixth period and tells me he feels like crap and is going home to die. Don't, I tell him. That would really upset Mom. My immediate first instinct is to ask him how I'm supposed to get to Jess's if he goes home sick. But then I remember Jess telling me that not everything is about me and that putting yourself in someone else's shoes is part of social interactions. Not literally, I would not fit in Theo's shoes. He wears a 10.5 while I wear a 12. So I tell Theo to feel better, and then I go to the guidance counselor, Mrs. Grenville. We examine the map Jess has given me and decide that I should take bus H5 and get off at the third stop. She even draws a route in highlighter pen from the bus stop to the house. As it turns out, the map is a very good one, even if it's not drawn to scale. After I get off the bus, I turn right at the fire hydrant and then count 6 houses on the left. Jess's new temporary home is an old brick house with ivy growing up the sides. I wonder if she knows that the tendrils of ivy can break apart mortar and brick. I wonder if I should tell her. If someone told me, I would lie in bed at night wondering if the whole house was going to crumble around me. I am still very nervous when I ring the front doorbell, because I have never seen the inside of this house before, and that makes me feel like my bones have gone to jelly. No one answers, so I go around the back. I glance down at the snow and make a mental note of what I see, but it isn't really important because the door is unlocked, and that must mean Jess is expecting me. I feel myself relaxing already. It's just like her dorm room. I will go in and wait, and when she returns, everything will be back to normal. There are only two times that Jess has gotten angry with me, and both occurred while I was waiting for her to show up. The first was when I took all her clothes out of her closet and arranged them according to the electromagnetic color spectrum, like mine. The second time was when I sat down at her desk and noticed the calculus problem set she was working on. She'd done half the problems wrong, so I fixed them for her. Theo is the person who made me understand that the rules of violence are based on threat. If there is an actual problem, there are only two options. One, retaliation. Two, confrontation. It's gotten me into trouble. I've been sent to the principal's office for smacking a boy who threw a paper airplane at me during English class. When Theo ruined one of my forensic experiments in progress, I went into his bedroom with a pair of scissors and systematically hacked his comic book collection to bits. Once, in eighth grade, I found out that a group of kids were making fun of me, and as if someone had flipped an electrical switch inside me, I went into a frantic rage. I huddled in a cubicle in the school library, crafting a hit list of the people I hated and how I would like their lives to end. Knife wound in the locker room at gym, bomb in their locker, cyanide in their Diet Coke. As is the Aspergian nature, I'm fanatically organized about some things and disorganized about others. And as luck would have it, I lost that piece of paper. I figured someone, maybe me, had thrown it out. But my history teacher found it and gave it to the principal, who called my mother. She yelled at me for 79 straight minutes, mostly about how violated she felt by my actions. And then she got even more angry because I couldn't really understand why something I did had upset her. So she took 10 of my Crime Busters notebooks and ran them through her bill shredder, page by page. And suddenly, her point was crystal clear. I was so furious that night, I dumped the bin of shredded paper over her head while she was asleep. Luckily, I didn't get suspended. Most of the administration of the school knew me well enough to know that I was not a threat to public safety. But my mother's lesson was enough to make me see why I could never do anything like that again. I say all this by way of explanation. Impulsiveness is part of what it means to have Asperger's. And it never ends well.
Emma. I'm allowed to work at home on my column, but every Tuesday afternoon I have to trot downtown to meet with my editor. Mostly it's a therapy session. She tells me what's wrong with her life and expects me to dole her out advice, the way I do for the masses in the paper. I don't mind, because I think that 1 hour a week of counseling is a pretty fair trade for a paycheck and health insurance. But it also means that on Tuesdays, when Jacob meets with Jess, she's responsible for getting him back to our house. Tonight, as soon as I walk through the door, I find Theo in the kitchen. "How do you feel?" I ask, pressing my palm against his forehead. "Do you have a fever?" I'd called home from Burlington, like I usually do before I leave the office, only to find out that Theo was sick and frantic because he'd left school without remembering that today is the day he walks Jacob to his appointment with Jess. A second call to the guidance department kept me from panicking. Mrs. Granville had talked to Jacob about taking a bus to Jess's new house and said he felt confident about doing it on his own.
"It's just a cold," Theo says, ducking away. "But Jacob's not home yet and it's past 4:30.
He doesn't really need to say any more. Jacob would rather saw off his arm with a butter knife than miss an episode of Crime Busters. But Jacob's only 15 minutes later than normal. Well, he was meeting Jess somewhere new today. Maybe it's a little farther away than her dorm was.
"But what if he never got there?"
Theo says, visibly upset.
"I should have just stayed in school and walked him there like usual."
"Honey, you were sick.
Besides, Mrs. Grenville thought this might be a good opportunity for Jacob to be independent. And I think I've got Jess's new phone number on my email. I can call if it makes you feel better. I wrap my arms around Theo. It's been too long since I hugged him. At 15, he ducks away from physical affection. But it's sweet to see him worried about Jacob. There might be friction between them, but at heart, Theo loves his brother. I'm sure Jacob's fine, but I'm glad he's got you looking out for him, I say. And in that instant, I make a snap decision to capitalize on the goodwill Theo's feeling for Jacob. Let's go out for Chinese tonight, I suggest, even though eating out is a luxury we can't afford. Plus, it's harder to find food Jacob can eat if I don't make it myself. An unreadable expression crosses Theo's face, but then he nods. That would be cool, he says gruffly, and he slides away from my grasp. The door to the mudroom opens. Jacob? I call, and I go to meet him. For a moment, I can't speak. His eyes are wild, and his nose is running. His hands flap at his sides as he shoves me into the wall and runs up to his room. Jacob! He has no lock on his bedroom door. I removed it years ago. Now, I push the door open and find Jacob inside his closet, underneath the tendrils of shirt cuffs and sweatpants, rocking back and forth and emitting a high, reedy note from his throat. What's the matter, baby? I say, getting down on my hands and knees and crawling into the closet too.